Hi, everybody. I'm Sue. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm one half of the dynamic duo of Sue and Stan. And he asked me to introduce our speaker tonight, which I was just delighted to be able to do. Can't hear me? Okay, sorry. Melissa is a friend of mine. A couple years ago, I had changed my home group and she was there. So I stalked her because, as you will see, she's somebody you want to stalk. She's and we've become, and I hope I'm not overspeaking here, but very good friends. I feel like she doesn't live far from me, and I feel like she's literally the type of friend that I could just go over at any given time if I really needed something. And she would have the doors wide open. I've had a lot of time to spend with her, and it's all been quite enjoyable. And a couple of months ago, she told her story at my home group. And that day, that night, as I listened to her tell her story, I thought, she's got to do this at Ridgeview. Because I think that there's going to be so many people in here that can relate to her story. And I don't think I'm wrong on that. Since she's been selling her product at Spring Fling, so many of y'all have gotten so that y'all refer to her as the soap lady. I don't think I've told her that before, but I'm going to say that now because then you'll also understand why I give her credit for the reason my bathroom smells so fantastic all the time, because I stockpile her product because I'm so afraid I'll run out of something. And with that, I will give you Melissa D.
This is a lot bigger meeting than I thought it was going to be. My name's Melissa, and I'm an addict and alcoholic. Hey, y'all. And if you don't hear anything else tonight, that's the most important thing I'm going to say all night long. I never thought I was an addict. I never thought I was an alcoholic. And I fought it for many years because I didn't want to be like y'all. Because my idea of an alcoholic was, everybody in my family, my neighbors, you know, drunk on the side of the road, living in a cardboard box, which I never was going to do, and I ended up doing. Mine was a refrigerator box, though, so I was a little highbrow. But, you know, I wasn't those things. I wasn't ever going to be an addict, and I wasn't ever going to be an alcoholic. And I certainly wasn't going to be like any of y'all. And by the grace of God, one day I kind of figured out that I am an addict and I am an alcoholic and I am just like all of y'all. You know, I never know what I'm going to say when I get up here and I say a little prayer and I ask God just to tell me what to say. So here we go. This is what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. You know, I really didn't have that remarkable of a childhood. My parents were really normal. My grandparents, my uncles, everybody in my family were alcoholics. So my parents, by God, were not going to become alcoholics at all. So my dad worked. He was military. And we moved a lot when I was little. Was born over in England, and then we moved around quite a bit, and we moved to Duluth, Georgia, before there was a mall. So I had a British accent, and my mother dressed me funny, and I moved into the middle of nowhere, and it was interesting. I was the only white kid there who spoke different, and it was very different. They singled me out. So again, I had a reason that I was different. I was from another country. My parents sounded American. I didn't. We had a lot of Koreans at the time because it was early 80s. And so it was okay that they sounded different because they looked different. But I sounded different, looked like everybody else in Duluth. So it was interesting. I learned how to say, hey, y'all, and sweet tea the first week. I really tried to sound like everybody else, and it just, I lived there until I was 14, and I was always that girl who sounded different. They never forgot. And I was kind of a quirky little kid. I, you know, did my own thing, and, it was just a normal, average childhood. I really didn't have a lot of trauma. I didn't have abusive parents, but I was always, something was always wrong inside. Like, I knew I wasn't like them, and I wasn't like everybody else. I was just wrong. I was off. My mom used to like to say that I popped out, you know, saying, "Where's the party?" And I just went from a very young age, and I would go. And people just didn't really go like I went. I started drinking at a very young age. We would go down to my grandparents' house, and they had liquor cabinets that were locked up, and because my parents didn't have liquor. And so I would break into those cabinets and drink the Golden Sunshine. It was amazing. You could drink it and suck in a bunch of air, and it would burn like hell. And I thought that was great. My grandfather would give me little shots of bourbon in the morning when he was reading the newspaper. So it was a fun way to start the morning. So I really liked to go visit them. They would come up to Georgia to visit us, and they would always complain that the bourbon here was a little watered down up in Georgia, and it was because I would get into it and add water and food coloring. So they could never understand why my parents' alcohol in that cabinet that stayed there for the year was so weak. I know the first time I ever did hard drugs, I was nine. My aunt down in Florida did a lot of cocaine, and I stayed with her one night, and so I helped vacuum it up, and you don't do that. So I never got to stay with her again. they didn't like that. I drank when I could. I'd steal little stuff when I could. I'd do little things when I could. But it was still not like a out of the ordinary childhood. It was just, I felt awkward and uncomfortable. And if I could get a hold of something, I would. When I was 14, I started doing drugs. Anything I could take. I was kind of the Mikey of the group. It was like, oh, let Melissa try it. She'll like it. She'll try it. We'll see what it will do. Because I would take anything. It didn't matter. We moved over to Cobb County when I was 14, and that was like this massive culture shock. I went from Duluth, Georgia, to East Cobb. And we'd never had a lot of money, ever. And we moved over into this area where there was money and status and people worried about what kind of clothes they wore. We just didn't do that. And so again, I didn't fit in, kind of the prevailing. And I really decided when I moved over here to Marietta, I was not gonna be a druggie. I was not gonna hang out with the drug addicts. I was going to be a preppy. And I was going to be part of the in crowd, and I was going to be accepted, and everybody would think that I was normal. And I really tried. I bought this outfit, which we didn't have the money for, but my parents splurged and bought me this outfit, and I was going to fit right in with everybody. And I did not. Everybody was so different over here. And within 2 weeks, I found my tribe again and was doing drugs. And drinking every morning before school, and you know, it was right back the way it had been. And my parents, keep in mind, my dad was in the military and became a salesman, and he was when he was on the ships, he was the one in charge of the drug addicts and alcoholics. He got to deal with them. And my mother was a special needs teacher and social worker, and so she always dealt with the drug addicted kids. And then they had me, and they had no idea. It was just like, not our child. And I was really good at lying and manipulating, and you know, I could kind of keep my grades up. I do really well, and then I drop down, and I worked a lot. We had to have a third income in, so I got a job at 14, and that income went to my parents. So I had ways to make money and keep it from them and still give to them. And, you know, it was just... I think it's really easy to look around you and say, all of y'all have it, but not in our family. So I was able to get away with a lot more. High school was really awkward and uncomfortable. It was still the same. I never really fit in. I didn't feel like I belonged. And everybody kind of did, you know, it was just like normal. Everybody would go out and drink at a high school party, and I would keep drinking and keep drinking and keep drinking. And people were uncomfortable having me come to the party because they knew I would break something, wreck something, steal something. Cops would get called. And it was generally because I just would take it another step further. So it was very easy to go off and do my own thing and not drink or use with them because they just didn't get me and I didn't get them, and again, I didn't fit. I got a job at a coffee shop, and I loved it. And by that time, I was using every morning. I'd do cocaine in the morning to get up. I'd drink all day. I'd smoke pot all day, and then I'd do heroin at night. I was almost 17 when I discovered that. And that, my whole world changed. I'd gotten into a really bad car accident when I was 15 and broke my leg and was in the hospital and in a wheelchair for 4 or 5 months and crutches forever and had surgery after surgery after surgery. And it was there that I discovered narcotics and just went to town. So around 17, I started shooting it because I couldn't get the pills from the doctors anymore. They wouldn't give it to me because apparently after 2 years of physical therapy, you really don't need pain pills every day. I thought I did, but they didn't. So they took that away, so I had to find another avenue. I kind of graduated high school. They graduated me, I think, just so that I would leave. I was given a dare by one of the teachers. They were like, if you can make it the last 3 weeks every day, we'll graduate you. And they were like, but you won't be able to. And so, of course, I did. I came every single day. And I worked at night and graduated. And I don't know. I looked around. I didn't really know what I was going to do with my life or where I was supposed to go. And everybody else was going off to college, so I thought I would try that. So that summer, I made a decision to go to college. And I graduated. I guess I graduated in May. And I had one of those rough weekends. I had a drug deal go bad and had the shit kicked out of me, got beaten up. I got raped, and I overdosed, you know, normal weekend. And I thought, this is really not the way it should be. My life is awful. And I was down and just... I had bruises everywhere, and everything was awful. And my whole life was just falling apart in this 1 3-day period. And you know that coffee shop? At 9:15 every night this group of people would come in. And they'd fill the coffee shop. And they'd drink coffee all night long and they'd tip like shit. And they were happy as hell. And every night they showed up. And when I fell and had to be picked up, those people picked me up. And they took me to my first meeting. And I got sober that summer. And it was a tough summer. 'Cause I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't want to be an addict. I wanted to be normal. Like, I wanted to be like what I thought I was supposed to be. I didn't want to be a junkie. I didn't want to be like my grandparents. I didn't want to be like y'all. And y'all took me to meetings every night. And you know how it is. We get sober, and in 30 days, life changes. I mean, I wasn't getting beaten up. I wasn't overdosing. People were talking to me, and things just suddenly became like hopeful. So I went to college. You know, and this is kind of the way I always looked at my life. It's, and I look back sometimes, it's like the decisions I made and the things I do, it's like, okay, I'm sober now, so I'm going to be like everybody else. And I had made that application, and I got accepted to this little bitty college in the middle of the mountains, and I'll go. So I did. And everybody in the meetings warned me. They said, don't go, you're not ready. I was like, I've got this, because I'm really good at running my life. And you know, how much trouble can you really get in North Georgia? So there were 300 kids at the, about 350 students at the college I went to. It was a young, it was in Young Harris, Georgia, and Young Harris College. And we had two cops, Ode and Joe, and I knew them both really well. Because obviously I didn't stay sober up there. And I'd get arrested a lot, and I'd spend the night with Ode and Joe while I sobered up. And, you know, because it just, I made it a couple weeks. I went to a couple meetings up in that area, and it just, it didn't work. So I had about 6 months sober and relapsed up there, and it was rough. And I came back. I had to leave college because it just wasn't working. So I came back down to the city and got sober again. And things were great. So I decided to move downtown. Because that was a smart decision. And I became a photographer for a little while. I wore 3-inch high heels and went and photographed bands and models and was out and going, and I had my shit together. And I didn't. I blew a couple really big opportunities. And this is what we do. It's like we are able to soar to the highest highs and then fall to the lowest lows. I got flown up to New York first class to go photograph and to test for this record label, because this was back before digital, so it was all film, and I was going to go and I was going to be their like house photographer and photograph bands, and but you know, they serve alcohol for free in first class, and I was going to stay sober. And so I didn't make it to my hotel, and I didn't make it to the photo shoot. And anyway, they flew me back a day and a half later and said they didn't need my services. So I was shocked. And, you know, I just couldn't understand. But they had great drugs in New York, and I just couldn't pass it up. So I came back, and life was just kind of exploding again, and it was all falling around my feet. And I remembered when I lived up in Young Harris, those couple weeks, how peaceful it was and how great it was and how everything was so good there. I thought, well, I'm either going to get sober or I'm going to die, one of the two. And I really liked living up there, and things were good, and it was calm and it was peaceful. So I'm going to go back up to Young Harris. So I packed everything up. I had a roommate at the time who I ditched, who had to move in with my parents, because she had nowhere else to go. And, you know, I just loaded my car up and took off for the mountains again and enrolled in school. Started a day later, I got a trailer over in North Carolina. It was fully furnished, had Christmas lights on it, and they were variable speed too, so you could change it. It was really fancy. And I got a fully furnished trailer on 5 acres of land in Hayesville, North Carolina for $250 a month. And I was set. I was going to get sober or I was going to die. That's what I was going to do. And I remember, like, the third night I was up there, Ode pulled me over because I was speeding. And he's like, what are you doing back here? It's like, oh, I'm here. I'm going to school again, and I'm sober. He's like, thank God. He's like, please, please don't get arrested again. So I stayed sober for about a week. I wasn't doing well. I started dealing again because college campuses are great places to make money. And I did well at that. I wasn't doing well at the whole school thing. I wasn't really doing well at anything. I had two cats with me. One of my cats, I tell this story, and I always make sure I tell this story. Because, you know, when we look at each other, when we look around this room, we all look like active, productive members of society. We forget sometimes the depths we go to. I forget sometimes. I look in the mirror and I'm like, God, you know, my life is so rough. I've got a mortgage and I've got responsibilities. And I forget about the stuff that we went through that got me to where I am today, and I get out of gratitude. You know, I get into that, oh, God, my life sucks. And I forget, you know, I did so much. I put so much into my system. I got real paranoid. They were out to get me. And my cat worked for them, she was a double agent, and she would report to them, and they coordinated with her. Because this big field I lived, you know, I had my trailer in this 5-acre field, and they would have night vision goggles. I have no idea why they needed that to watch me through my trailer at night. And so they gave my cat, this is what I believed, they implanted these little watching devices into these rats and mice and moles that she would then bring into the trailer to watch me. So I decided I had to eliminate her. And there were still some, like, normalcy back there that was like, don't kill the cat, because then they'll know that you know that they know. So I was so insane. So I would take these little voles that she would bring in, and I'd cut the little microchips out, and I would put them in, it had to be like 25 to 30 plastic bags, and put that little piece in, and then I put the little dead mouse in another 25 or 30 bags, and then I would drive, because it had to be across state lines. So at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm driving around Hayesville, North Carolina, Young Harris, Blairsville, Hiawassee, depositing bags of trash bags with little bits of dead animals my cat had brought me to monitor me into separate dumpsters across state lines so that they wouldn't be able to watch me. And I believed this. Like, I really truly believed that somebody was using my cat to watch me. I was so insane. And it seemed so real. So I had a dog with me for a little while, and my dog, I had left her in the trailer for 3 days, and no food, no water, because I had passed out somewhere, and I decided, you know, that she needed to go back and live with my parents. So I had somebody drive me down to Marietta because I couldn't drive, and I left my dog. I tried to take their TV, but it was too heavy, so I had to leave it in the foyer. They didn't like that. Because I was really good at taking things that I could carry and pawn them. By this point, my parents kind of knew that there was something going on. And that best friend that I had left in the apartment, high and dry, went to them and said, Melissa has a problem. I don't know if you know this, but she's got a problem. So they made this plan, and they all came together, and they got these court orders, and they all showed up at the trailer. I was passed out, and they woke me up, and they're banging on the trailer, and I thought they had come for me. And it was my parents and my best friend, and they loaded everything up, and I was given a couple options. I could go with them and go into a court-ordered treatment center, or I could face criminal charges. And I think it was like 16 or 17 felony counts and misdemeanors, and it was insane. So, you know, you got the marshal standing there, and you got my dad and my mom, and my mom's sad, and they're taking all my stuff, and I'm like, okay, I'll go with you, but let me go to the bathroom real quick. You know, and I'm like shoveling as much stuff in my system as I can. And then I went, they took me to Charter Peachford, and I kind of remember the drive down. I don't really remember much. They said that when they were doing the intake, I sat there and I looked around and I was like, these are not my people. I don't know if you know this, but these are alcoholics and drug addicts. And a woman was like, yes, you're in the right place. She offered me a Diet Coke. And I was like, oh, I do not drink Diet Coke. It has NutraSweet in it. Do you know that that will do to your body? So I lectured this woman, and I don't have any memory of it, but I've seen her from time to time over the years, and she always asks me, she's like, would you like a Diet Coke? So when they took me in, I was 67 pounds. I was hot. I had cigarette burn marks all over my chest because I would nod out, and I set my trailer on fire a couple of times, which my landlord didn't like. But I had sores all over my body. I'd pass out all the time. I had one pair of shorts and a tank top that would sort of fit. And that was it. And then whatever I could shovel in, whatever I could consume, I did. I had that Young Harris ID, so I could get, for 50 cents, I could get a biscuit at this local biscuit place. And with that ID, I'd get a cinnamon roll for free. So I lived on cinnamon rolls. I can't eat them to this day. I get a little funny. But I get one cinnamon roll a week, and I get a biscuit. And then I'd load up on moonshine and liquor and whatever drugs I could, and that's how I survived. So, and I thought I was okay. I really thought I was okay. I didn't think that I had a problem. And I definitely didn't need to be in a treatment center, not with drug addicts and alcoholics, and I sure as hell didn't need that Diet Coke. I was so delusional. I don't really remember the first week of treatment. I don't really remember much. But that first month, I was there for a month, and then the court order, I had to go into a long-term treatment facility. But I remember, you know, one of the kids from the campus came down because nobody was selling because I had been locked up and wanted to know if he could get some weed from me. And I was like, do you see where I am? I can't help you. But this guy, I do remember there was that moment of clarity. It was the first time I'd ever really had a moment of clarity, like, this is not the life I want. This guy's wife had smuggled some weed in for him. And, you know, we had this, like, exterior smoking. It was all chain link. You felt like you were in a dog cage. And so we could go out there and smoke. And he offered me one. And it was the first moment I'd ever had where I made a conscious decision, where I decided not to do it, where I decided this is not the life I want. And I said no. And it wasn't easy from that moment on. I went into long-term treatment. I was going to get out and move to Colorado with this guy I was seeing, and we had all these plans, and I was just going to get sober long enough so that I didn't have the charges, so I could get through this court deal, so that nothing would stick, and I could get out. And you know, something changed. For the first time in my life, I wanted to live. I wanted to, and not just survive, but I wanted to live. Because I had survived for so long. I wanted to live. And I saw, you know, the two times I had been sober before, you know, those people were still around, and they still came to see me, and they still did, you know, the deal. They were still doing the same things, and I was still running and trying to escape whatever it was inside of myself that made me hate myself. So I always fought everything, but somehow or another I made it through this treatment, and they actually allowed me to get out early. And I was terrified because I knew I was going to go back to using, because that's what I've always done. And my parents allowed me to move in with them. And I went to meetings every day. I bartended, because that's what I'd always done. But I'd go to meetings in the morning. I'd go to lunchtime meetings. I'd go to the Dawn Busters meeting over at 8111, because I'd get off of work, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning and go eat, and then I'd go to Dawn Busters. Life started to happen, and I allowed it to happen. I didn't fight it like I'd always fought it. It really works. I was telling my story one time. I had like 3 years sober. I used to go to this, it was called the Log Cabin. It was a CA clubhouse off of Buford Highway. And I think I had like 3 years sober at the time. And this great big old guy comes up to me and he was like, "You don't look like enough fucking junkie." I was like, "Thank you. Thank you." Because I would hate to have 3 years sober and people still look at me and think I'm a junkie, you know? I don't want to be that person again. I don't want to walk around and people go, "I know what she does." You know, people don't hide their kids from me anymore. People, in fact, and actually this is funny as shit. In sobriety, a lot of things have happened. I've become a completely different person. I got married and divorced to someone in the program. I've become a really big believer that you have to do what you say you're going to do, and you are who you say you are in all aspects of your life. Like, you don't get to just talk about this program. You don't get to come in here for 1 hour a day and say the 12 steps and say a prayer and go home. You have to live this program. Like, you have to take it out of these rooms. And you have to carry this message everywhere you go, in your actions, in the way you think, because I still think like a junkie. My first thought is always wrong, always. And then I have to step back and say, what's the next right thing? So I got married, I got divorced, I became a farmer, which is totally different from what I thought I'd do. And I became a foster parent. I never wanted kids, but the state of Georgia gave me 5 of them. and it was really funny. I was standing before the judge one time. "Is there any reason we shouldn't give you these children? Is there anything we should know?" And I had, you know, all these things going through my head. And I was like, "No, sir, there is not." Because fortunately, my record only has like 3 misdemeanors on it. So grace of God and because of my parents and because of these people who really cared about me and loved me, fixed things for me and helped me. And because I did the deal and because I continued doing the things I was supposed to do, I stayed out of trouble, sort of, you know? My daughter is me. We're 12 and a half years apart, and I was her 11th home, and I got her and I met her and I was like, oh my God, it's my kid. So I dealt with this teenager bringing cocaine into my house, into a sober home. I dealt with getting my kid out of jail twice in 1 week. That was fun. And my mom and my dad were like, oh, awesome. They were really happy. You know, it's life is bizarre. I go to meetings frequently. I have a home group that I'm active in. I sponsor. I am sponsored. And that's a big part of it, is that I allow myself to be sponsored. I ask for help, and when I'm given suggestions, I take it. It's hard, because I think I know the right way. I always want to do it my way, and my way always gets me into trouble. But I have a body care business now. My best friend and I do that. And so I make soap for a living. I still have a farm. I moved back down here to Marietta. I was living in North Georgia for 14 years. And my first instinct when I got a divorce was to move to the middle of nowhere, get a trailer, live on the land, and have nobody around me. But, you know, I got in the program, I guess about 8 years sober, 9 years sober, I stopped going to meetings because all of the promises came true. Everything I had ever wanted came true. I mean, I wasn't a billionaire, but, you know, it was like I was happy and I was active and I was productive. And so I quit going to meetings. And then I got miserable and complacent. And I wasn't using, but I kind of thought about killing myself. It was like, this is not the way I want to live. And I went to a retreat. Somebody suggested it. They called me up. They said they were having an AA retreat. I should go. I was like, I haven't been to a meeting in 6 months. And they were like, yeah, you should go. And I went, and it recharged me. And what I learned from that is that I can't stray. Like, I have this ism, and I'm always going to be an alcoholic addict. It's never going to go away. My brain thinks differently. And when I come to these meetings, I get the medicine I need. I get the infusion of hope that I need. And I'm hanging out with my tribe, with my people, because y'all get me and I get you. And so I have to stay here because this is where I found God. This is where I found myself. And this is where I continue to find myself. And I'm terrified that if I stray, then I'll go back out to being that liar and that thief and that addict and that junkie. And all these things, this family I've been given, and you know, even now it's like I've got an incredible life. I've got relationships, and it's not perfect because I'm crazy as hell, but it's like I know now when I act out and I try my best to make those amends and to fix it before it gets out of hand. I try and behave. And it's made my life so smooth. I mean, I have those ups and downs and the bumps, but now I have all these tools that help me deal with it. So by the grace of God, my sobriety date is November 10th, 1997. For an addict alcoholic like me, I never thought I'd live past 18 or 21. And I'll be 40 this year, which is crazy. Because I still feel 12. But, you know, I've grown up in this program, and I've had people in this program love me and help me and support me through it. And, you know, hopefully I'll be sober tomorrow. So, thanks.
Gosh, I thought you were always normal.